Hello, this is a show from Radio. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners.
Delta 2 Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond.
Delta 2 Yankee, Delta 2 Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Are you up for it?
$15 next year if elected. Labour's also pledged to put $800 million towards encouraging research and development. It will mean employers and farmers will pick up the cost. Patrick Gower reports.
So, election day is November 8th, which, it seems from legal commentary over the weekend, was totally obvious to political insiders who are election day is November 8th, which, it seems from media commentary over the weekend, was totally obvious to political insiders or had been obvious just since they stopped thinking it could be an election, in which case October 18 had been the screamingly obvious option. Unless, of course, aliens landed and called the whole thing off. Unlikely, but a possibility that some insiders say cannot be ruled out entirely at this time. Over the next few weeks, we'll be seeing a lot of horse-based political journalism, which is defined in the dictionaries as being media coverage that focuses on poll results and political battles instead of policy issues. Horse-race journalism reaches its peak in election campaigns, but it has chronically infected political coverage. One reason the substance of policy is not communicated, the Washington Post's David Broder once commented, is that reporters carry over to their coverage of government the campaign mindset of horse-race journalism. Process stories predominate, and the emphasis is on, well, who is gaining or losing, not on what is being done. About 55 days now remain before the voters get to decide the election result. Or, to put that another way, we have some 55 more days of media noise about who is ahead, who is closing fast, who is coming up from the pack, who is surprisingly off the pace, and which one of our about 68 niche voting segments may prove decisive in the final sprint to the finish line. Not to mention how the latest polls are showing the race is tightening and the gap is narrowing. Or not. And November 8th will start a whole cycle all over again with any residual doubt remaining on election night as to who can form the government. Journalism that analyses the process of politics rather than its content has recognisable features. Most of them foster the myth that the media has inside knowledge or reliable predictive power about how the election process will unfold. They/we are usually groping in the dark as mere spectators, not as insiders. We're guessing, being spun, and are spinning the public in turn, at best on the basis of hand signals from the coaches of Team Labour and Team National, and at worst on sheer bluff and hedging at bets. Some features of horse race journalism you can expect to see a lot more of during the next 55 days. One, subjunctive forecasting. Those little words, may and if, are the political journalist's best friends. John Armstrong's Herald column on Saturday offered both a preview of campaign racecourse conditions, track likely to be ugly and nasty, much dirt expected, and this excellent example of subjunctive forecasting. Key's political instincts are solid, but they will tempt him to take some risks. Some may pay off, but he will make mistakes. They won't matter if they're minor. They will if they're major. Right, this just about covers the possible options. Those solid political instincts of Key's may lead him to act like a flake, but that won't matter to the outcome, unless it does. Or unless he's an alien, which is a possibility some insiders can't say cannot be ruled out entirely at this time. 2. Hells as moral arbiters. Since, to the media, the campaign race is the story, opinion polls become a palpable reality that provides a running verdict on success or failure. However, the polls are mute on the reasons for the trends they record, and on how the politicians feel about them. Therefore, the media's role will be to helpfully flesh out the polls and cloak the players with moral dimensions and their alleged reactions to them. For example, Helen Clark, who went with in her drive to win a historic fourth term, is becoming desperate in the face of polls that show the reins of power are finally slipping from her grasp, etc., etc., while John Kelly, basking in the results of polls that show National could govern alone, is already planning beyond election day. Yet, with a great deal of good-humoured humility about the scale of the task before him, etc., etc. Or, to quote from the excellent Armstrong column again, Labour, with an iron willed leader who has rallied in a fresh, retiring team, is hell-bent on retaining occupancy of the ministerial suites in the Beehive. On the other side stands National. There are still questions about its readiness to govern, but more its determination to do so. National has been out of power for 9 years. A further 3 years in opposition is simply not an option. National has positioned itself to win. Not only has it rebuilt itself as a true Conservative Party close to the thinking of most New Zealanders, rather than a radical party of the right, but it also has a leader who carries none of the baggage from the last time National was in government. The problem is that many of his front bench colleagues do. That is why Helen Clark intends making this election about trust. That suggests hers will be a more negative campaign than a positive one. The problem is that our government has become mired in seemingly endless distractions and seems to have lost focus. That is why John Key is making this election about New Zealand turning a fresh page with a new government. So, let's sum that up. Core messages, Labour, Iron World Leader, hell-bent, purposes retaining ministerial suites, mired, endless distractions, lost focus. Core messages, National, determination, rebuilt, too conservative, close to the thinking of most New Zealanders. Not radical. Baggage exists on National front bench, but Labour would be negative if it pointed that out. Key's purpose is in making New Zealand turn a fresh page. New government. Yes, just as well we have the season hands at the Herald to guide us towards race day in our little democracy. Thank goodness we're not dependent on that lot out there in the blogosphere. Experts and media commentators are virtually unanimous in their view that internet comment, while lively, is rife with error and uninformed bias. 3. The experts say, to convey the sense of insiderdom and status as founts of special wisdom, the media will tap its expert sources. Very special, extremely savvy sources. So, watch out for insiders say, or well-placed sources say, or an unnamed source close to the party confirms. Often, this means simply the journalist has agreed to be spun by the party machine for purposes of its own. Don't get me wrong, access is necessary for some stories. That's certainly what the press pass does provide you. It gets you conditional entry to the political locker room, where, unless you're very sharp, you readily become a conduit for the worldview of the players and their coaches. Staying outside is just as important for the readers, though it is not as highly valued by media managers. And 4, the jump cut and the hedged bet. To convey a sense of mastery, the media will sometimes make a bold prediction. This is usually a leap in the dark, masquerading as insider knowledge. Usually, it is about as much factual underpinning as a bet on red 11 on the roulette wheel at Vegas. Take as an example last week's widespread and boldly stated assumption that Helen Clark would fire Winston Peters on Thursday. Clearly, it was a wrong call, but one premised on the reassuring knowledge that the media cycle spins fast enough to bury the wrong guesses pretty quickly. So she'll fire him this week instead, after the Brian Henry testimony on Tuesday at the Privileges Committee. That was from 2008, by Gordon Campbell.
There's no confidence in the national government, led by John Key, which has borrowed heavily and created a record deficit of $16.7 billion. Has no plan and no vision to improve New Zealand's economic performance. Has broken its promise not to cut entitlements to KiwiSaver and working families. Has made cuts that will hurt, but will not solve New Zealand's economic difficulties. And has failed to act in the interest of all New Zealanders. Mr. Speaker, today New Zealand needed a budget that gave it a shot in the arm, needed a vision for a better future and how to get there. We got neither, Mr. Speaker. There is nothing innovative or transformative in this budget that will address New Zealand's economic problems. In fact, Mr. Speaker, this is the worst budget that I have seen in 27 years in this house.
Latest 3 News Read research poll is out and has National opening up its already massive gap over Labour. And one of the real winners in the poll is the Greens, who now seem to be feeding off Labour's misery and taking their voters. Political editor Duncan Garner is in the studio with more. Duncan.
But anyway, John Key's charmed run with voters just continues. There were just 4 months to the election. He looks completely unrivaled. His main competition, Labour leader Phil Goff, continues to lose ground, and he's losing it to his mates, the Greens. So let's go and have a look at the numbers. Still is up 2.1 to 55.1. We've had them between 53 and 55 now for the last 2 years. Labour drops back almost 3 points to 29.9. That's the second lowest we've had them in the last 2 years. The Greens are starting to cannibalise Labour's vote a bit. They're up 2.6 to 9.1. That's the highest vote ever for the Green Party in a 3 News Read research poll. Winston Peters' New Zealand First Party is really going nowhere, back to 2.2. If you have a look at the ACT Party, they're down 0.5 to 1.7. That's the same level for the ACT Party as when Don Brash rolled Rodney Hyde. The Māori Party comes back at half this vote, actually to 0.8. The Mana Party, this is Honi Haruwera's party, picks up a couple of mini points there to 0.7. It is looking reasonably strong for a party so young. And Peter Dunn has exactly zero support amongst all the parties that you see here tonight. And the preferred Prime Minister stakes, John Key, is at 50.5. He's up a couple couple of points there. Phil Goff is down a little bit to 6.9. He is flatlining at this here. He just cannot get past that 7 on our poll. Winston Peters is at 3.9. Got a bit of support out there. And Helen Clark, well, she's still got one or two supporters out there, and she is at 1.7. So Key remains dominant and on track for a second term, but there's a real warning here for Labour. Their mates, the Greens, are starting to eat into their support.
John Key's been out selling the country and hanging out with the beautiful people.
I think not just a director, I think he could be an actor because he just got it right.
Voters still overwhelmingly think National's getting it right at home too. 55% support in tonight's poll, a 25-point gap over Labour, with the election just 16 weeks away.
Well, I think what it reflects is that New Zealanders are supporting the direction it's going to take the country.
The Prime Minister's had pretty high publicity with his trips to India. Publicity every day, you'd expect the government to go up.
So Goff's answer is a capital gains tax, a tax on investment properties, shares, farms and the sale of businesses. He's hoping his announcement this Thursday will turn the polls.
People are waiting to hear Labour's answers, and very soon they will be. And that gives us a chance, I think, to reach out and lift our poll rating.
But the Prime Minister has already got his lines worked out.
If you want lower taxes, vote for National. If you want higher taxes, vote for Labour.
What should also concern Goff is that the Greens have taken 3 points off of Labour. The Greens now want lines worked out.
If you want lower taxes, vote for National. Higher taxes, vote for Labour.
What should also concern Goff?
Vote for National. Vote for Labour.
He got his lines worked out.
Lower taxes, vote for Labour. Higher taxes.
What should also concern Goff is that the Greens have But the Prime Minister has already got his lines worked out. But the Prime Minister has already got his lines worked out. What should also concern Goff is that the doing well in just 13.9.
The Greens and the Labour Party will be likely coalition partners in the next election.
We also asked voters in this poll how the leader is performing. Almost 3 in 4 voters think Key is doing well, and just 13.9% say he's doing a poor job. For Goff, just 1 in 4 voters think he's doing well, and 1 in 2 now think he's doing a poor job. So in the main battle, Key versus Goff, it's certainly one-way traffic. Remember, just 6.9% for Phil Goff as Prime Minister. Just 4 months to go for the election for Labour, this is no laughing matter.
Now, poll came out of the field mid-week, so any support or lack of it for Labour's new capital gains tax plans doesn't actually show up in this poll, but on these numbers tonight, Labour is in for complete annihilation on November the 26th. The government's earthquake package appears to be largely accepted by voters, but of course some in Christchurch still say it's not good enough. So all the pressure is now on Goff to sell his capital gains tax package, but it certainly won't be easy. As modern salesman like John Key is, he must now pull off some kind of Houdini act, if you like, to convince voters of this new capital gains tax. The tax, of course, targets the rich, the investor, business owners and farmers, and it's good like that the leader should actually be able to sell that kind of tax. It certainly needs some kind of silver bullet, promoting and winning support for this big new tax proposition to test Goff in every possible way.
Luxurious sparkle from Hot Spring Spa. Became mathematical logic. On the other hand, Aristotle's practical logic, which comprised a study of sophistical refutations or fallacies, which comes under the heading of dialectical reasoning, in which two parties reason with each other, fell into obscurity and neglect. Something approximating a resurrection of it was attempted in the 19th century, most notably, when idealist philosophers wrote about so-called laws of thought. With the ascendancy of formal, mathematical, logic, however, the whole idealist vision of laws of thought was repudiated, and called psychologism a pejorative term, as then used in logic. A sharp separation was made between how people actually think, psychologically, and how they ought to think, logically, if they are to be rational. Now you return from this thumbnail sketch, it can be seen why in logic there is thought to be a sharp separation between the empirical and normative viewpoints. Recent developments, however, have started to indicate that this separation is not as clean or sharp as it was thought to be. One recent development is the return to the quest, originating in Aristotle's older logic of the topics and on sophistical refutations, studying informal fallacies. It had been found that to study the fallacies with any hope of success, attention must be paid to realistic cases in which arguments are used for various conversational purposes in different contexts. Such an approach requires getting beyond simplistic one-liner examples of fallacies and looking at individual cases in some detail on their merits. Needless to say, such a pragmatic case-oriented approach to realistic argumentation introduces something of an empirical component, while the abstract form of the argument, the so-called argumentation scheme, logic, dialectic, and rhetoric is still very important. One also has to look seriously at how an argument has been used for some conversational purpose, supposedly, from what can be judged from a given text of discourse. The pragmatic study of arguments used in a given case is no longer purely formal and abstract. It has become contextual. Much depends on how you interpret a given text of discourse as expressing an argument or some other speech act. This pragmatic approach seems to make the traditional separation of abstract form and contextual content much more difficult to maintain. This pragmatic approach to taking actual cases seriously is characteristic of the schools of thought now called informal logic and argumentation theory. The general theoretical approach can be described briefly as follows. The goals are the identification, analysis, and evaluation of argumentation. The field of argumentation is centrally concerned with arguments, but must also take account of related things, such as explanations and the asking of questions, and are not themselves arguments but nevertheless occur in an important way in sequences of argumentation. The ultimate goal is to evaluate arguments, that is, to judge in a given instance of its use how strong or weak an argument is, and to judge whether the premises support the conclusions as good reasons for accepting them. Johnson 2000, Final Juro 2005, semicolon Morage 2006. The typical kind of case dealt with is one in which an argument of some sort has supposedly been put forward in a text of discourse in a given case. In this typical kind of case, the proponent is not around to defend her argument. The argument is expressed in some fairly short text of discourse presented in the logic classroom. The source of the text is known. It may be a magazine or newspaper article, a book, a transcript of a political speech, a transcript of a legal case, or any sort of text of discourse that appears to contain an interesting argument of some sort. The critics, usually a professor and a group of students, that undertake the task of identifying, analyzing, and evaluating the argument. Usually, an argument is selected because it fits the format of one of the famous informal fallacies. However, such arguments can be quite reasonable in many instances and are by no means necessarily fallacious. The game is to try to judge, in a given case, how the given argument, as far as it can be analyzed and pinned down, should be evaluated. Is it fallacious, or just weak in certain respects and not so badly off that it should be called fallacious? Or is it reasonable, that is, should it be judged to be basically correct from a structural point of view, even though it may lack parts that are missing or that are not very well backed up, as far as can be judged from what is known from the given text of discourse and the old dialectic of the Greeks, its presumed context? In many cases, there simply isn't enough context given to support a definitive evaluation. Even in such cases, however, what is called a conditional evaluation can be very informative and even enlightening. The viewpoint of informal logic is typically from a backward perspective. That is, you are typically confronted with a dead specimen, an argument that has already been put forward and is now embedded in some text of discourse that is being examined. The argument, presumably, is already over, and you are looking at it retrospectively. For example, the case you are studying may be from a political debate in a parliament or a legislative assembly. The debate has already been concluded, perhaps long ago. So you are looking at it with all the benefit of 20/20 hindsight. This normative viewpoint, characteristic of modern argumentation theory and informal logic, has ancient roots. It goes back to the ancient but much neglected and misunderstood field called dialectic by the Greeks. To begin to grasp the nature of the interdisciplinary tensions between logic and rhetoric, it is necessary to go back to the roots of both subjects. To the old dialectic of the Greeks in the ancient world, dialectic was an art of questioning and replying in which the speech partners took turns. The questioner begins by asking a question that requires the respondent to make a choice on an issue. Once the respondent has chosen a position, the questioner can pursue the discussion further by drawing inferences based on the respondent's answers. Cap 1942, comma B12. The exact purpose of dialectic is not known, but the best known examples of it are the dialogues written by Plato in which Socrates plays the role of...
End of transmission. Find us on the internet, radia.fm. Over and out.